Okay, so sorry for the that's not very clear, but I'll be talking about lattice gauge theories and how they apply to condensed matter physics, and this is supposed to be a pedagogical talk. So I'm going to keep it very simple, and a lot of it will be about lattice gauge theories themselves. So that physics has been known for a long time now. In many ways, it's very simple physics. It's completely tractable in using very simple techniques. A couple of good reviews of just lattice gauge theories. One of them is Kogut's Reviews of Modern Physics, 79. That's the reference. I mean, I think the parts that you need are clear. And the other is this book by Polyakov, which is also, it's got lots of interesting things in it. Okay, so so while I'll mainly be talking about physics that's been known to these people for a long time and many other people for a long time, it'll turn out that in the context of condensed matter physics, there'll be some new twists and turns. So people who are familiar with that physics will also hopefully find something new today. Unfortunately, that stuff is not properly reviewed anywhere, so can't really give any references for that. But anyway, okay, so Leon has already given you a sort of introduction why gauge theories. Okay, and I'll be talking throughout in d equals 2 plus 1. So not 1D and not quantum Hall effect. So I'll be thinking of zero magnetic field situations. Okay, so it turns out that all examples we know, now there are several models, as Leon mentioned, and unfortunately I won't be talking about, and I won't have time to talk about any of these specific microscopic models today. But it turns out that all models we have of fractionalization in dimensions greater than one involve gauge theories. Okay, so it seems, at least at the present moment, almost inescapable that if you want to describe these fractionalized phases in higher dimensions, higher than one, you have to resort to gauge theories. Okay, so there are many reasons why this is sensible, but anyway, let me just start with one motivation for why this might be true. Let's imagine a spin model. Okay, so yeah. Let's say spin a half on some lattice, say square lattice. So the spins are really Pauli matrices, and okay. So if you just had this simple Hamiltonian, you could think of various phases that this might contain. But what we want to write down is something, a model. Let me write it down and then justify why we might want to look at this model. Okay, so what have I done over here? I've taken this model that we have on the square lattice, but introduced some other fields, which I'll describe in a moment. So the fields we now have are, instead of just having a single spin at every site, let's imagine that we have on every site a fermion, which carries a spin, so you have F up and F down, two fermion operators. And you have that at every site of this lattice, but they're allowed to hop, for example, through this term, and the hopping is mediated by the value of a link variable, sigma ij, and this operator has eigenvalues plus or minus one on every link. Okay, so that's
sigma z doesn't act on the spin space of the fermions.
Sigma Z doesn't act. It just depend. I mean, just mediates the hopping. It's yeah. There's a Pauli matrix at every link. It's not associated with the spin variables. It's a different, lives in a different space. Okay. So, and these particles are certainly not electrons. And the reason you can see that is that they couple to this sigma z, which is a gauge field. It'll become apparent in a minute why this has gauge symmetry. So certainly not an electron. But these will be useful variables to think of this problem in a more general context. Okay, so since these are not electrons, you can certainly have pairing terms. This respects spin symmetry. And also you can have terms that give you dynamics to this gauge field, to these sigma z's. So there's something that penalizes having flux, having a net net amount of flux in each of these plaquettes, and there's something that gives dynamics to these sigma z's. So sigma x is the Pauli matrix that's conjugate, you know, that's another Pauli matrix that lives in the same Hilbert space. Okay, so you can see immediately that this is a much larger Hilbert space than the spins, but what we'll be interested in is exploring the properties of this more general model, and I'll show you that in fact in some limits this model reduces just to the spin model that we have, but it turns out that this model has a much richer phase structure that can be very readily shown in these variables, and the hope is that some of these phases will also occur in a model written just in terms of spins. Okay, so that's the logic. Now, one of the things that's been really surprising in condensed matter physics, gauge theories in condensed matter physics, is that these gauge variables have emerged in models that have no gauge variables to begin with. Again, unfortunately, I can't review that development, but hopefully it'll be covered sometime during this workshop. But that's really one of the very striking things that happens. I'll take a different point of view over here that, you know, let's write down this model and show you that it has many desirable properties and then proceed analyzing this model and properties of gauge theories and so on.
So the Fs are unconstrained?
At the moment, they are unconstrained, but we'll put a constraint on them, on electric fields emanating from them. we'll recover the spin variables in a certain dynamical limit where the constraint will be imposed. So just give me a minute, you'll see how it works. Okay, so the first thing you realize is that this model has enormous symmetry, okay? Rather, there's certain transformations that you can do. So you can take pick any site you like and change the value of the, change the sign of the electron field at that site. So, so epsilon is some number that's either plus or minus one, and you make this transformation on the fermion variables. And also make a transformation on these gauge on these sigma fields. Okay, now it's very easy to see that this nothing changes in this model. Okay, so there's a local symmetry that you can write down. There's an operator that you can write down, which is minus one times the number of fermions in any site. At NR. So there's this local operator that you can write down, and acting this with this operator on any state gives you another state that's degenerate. And of course, there's such an operator for every site of your lattice. Okay, so now clearly that's a feature that we don't want. Okay, where's this enormous degeneracy coming from? It's certainly non-physical unless you have some very good reason for it, and we'd like to get rid of it in some way. Okay, so you just notice the following fact that the square of this operator is 1. So it basically takes on values either plus or minus 1 at every site. So you can restrict your Hilbert space until you can put a constraint on all physical states of your Hilbert space that they transform in a particular way when you hit them with this operator. Okay, so there are two obvious choices that you can make. Say that any one of these operators acting on a state just gives you back the same state, in which case, of course, you don't have this degeneracy. You just have one state which has this thing. Or you can have okay, you can have one of these two situations. So this will be called evenant. Now it will turn out that in, again, in condensed matter physics, you're allowed certain constraints that are not allowed when you require relativistic invariance. And that will give us some additional interesting physics that's not contained in regular, in the lattice gauge theories that have been studied for the last. Yeah, so GI is just implements this, makes this transformation. Right, so we just argued that Hamiltonian is invariant under this transformation, therefore, yeah.
Sir, what distinguishes these two things from arbitrary combinational pluses and minuses on the outside?
Yeah, so you want translation symmetry on the lattice. Okay. So
the. Checkerboard.
Yeah, you can, but then you break the, you have a different unit cell.
Yeah.
So these are physical things, what sign you have. You'll see that it's very physical what sign you have. Okay, so let me now show you that this model actually reduces to a very reasonable model in a certain limit. Okay, so before I do that, I just want to emphasize that this is something very characteristic of a gauge theory, that not only you have a Hamiltonian, you also have a local constraint. Okay, and that's what sort of the defining property of these of a gauge theory. Okay, so let's analyze this Hamiltonian. The limit. In the limit that h goes to infinity. Okay, so this is a limit where make it really you really want all your sigma x's to be equal to 1. There are many ways of thinking about this limit, but actually it's a limit where it makes it very expensive to create electric fields or the analogs of electric fields. So I'll try to give you some intuition for what these different things mean in terms of our electrodynamics that we are used to at some point. Okay. So you really want to be in the limit where sigma x equals 1 on all. Okay, so now it turns out it's more interesting to study this particular realization to begin with, the odd case. Okay, so I want a situation where my GRs are all minus 1, but each of my sigma x's are 1. Okay, so that just means that I need minus 1 to the NF on every site. Or that basically means that NFR is equal to 1. Okay, so that's the constraint that we wanted to get back a spin model. And you see that once you have one fermion per site, you can either have a state with an up spin or a down spin. Those are the two states allowed in every site of your Hilbert space. And of course, all your sigma x's have been set equal to 1. Okay, so you've got a problem where we basically have just one fermion per site, but there's an enormous degeneracy of states. Now, this is a physical degeneracy, because your spins can be anything on every site. Okay, so there's at this moment, in strictly this limit, there's this huge degeneracy. Okay, but we know how this degeneracy is lifted. Let's imagine that H is not quite infinite, something very large, and we'll do degenerate perturbation theory using these terms, okay, which hop these F particles, spin-ons if you like, which hop these F particles around. Okay, and it's clear that if you have two neighboring sites that are both upspin, then no hopping is allowed between the two. On the other hand, if they are antiferromagnetic, there's one up and one down, you're allowed to hop and you gain a little bit of energy from this degenerate perturbation theory. But of course, when you do this hop, you excite this bond. So there's a sigma z f dagger f. You excite this into this high energy state, which you have to pay energy h for. And at the end of the day, if you work out what your effective Hamiltonian in this low-energy subspace is, it's something that can be written simply in terms of the spin operators on every site. It's up or down. In fact, you can just guess what it's going to be. Not going to get the factors of 2 right. But. You can practically guess this answer. So you know it's got to be spin rotation symmetric. Therefore, the only operators you're allowed are s dot s on neighboring bonds and a constant. You know that if you have two spins that are parallel, then they can't hop. They can't gain any energy through this process. So you know the sign of this, and you know that if you have these both to be half, then this has got to cancel and give you zero. There's no energy gain, and of course it's second order perturbation theory, so you always lower your energy. So you can, just from these sort of arguments, you can get everything except the prefactor.
You okay. Illustrate is pretty usual, right? So
actually, it's just the
charge start out with one fermion per side. Okay, and it's just a potential making virtually.
Yeah. So if they're like this, yeah, if they're like this, then you can create a pair and get back down. If they're like this, you can't.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So at least on this limit, you get back, some very simple Heisenberg model that you started with, but this model has more than that, and the hope is that some more complicated Hamiltonian to begin with will end up in phases that this model exhibits. Okay, so let's, before we do that, let's get some intuition about...
And the next nearest neighbor are down by 8 squared, 1 over 8 squared.
Yeah, so every time you do a next, another hop, you hit it with a sigma z, which...
But are they t squared over h squared?
So you wanted two hops, like that. And so yeah, you have to get the dimensions right. So probably it'll be something like... So this counts the number of... I guess that'll be something like that.
So there's a strict limit where h goes to infinity and t squared plus delta squared goes to infinity. And you recover the Heisenberg model.
Exactly, yeah.
And these vanish at the same
time. Yeah. I could say this is the sort of degenerate state perturbation theory. So your first term wins. And yeah, you're home with that. Okay, so so let's get some intuition for what's going on with these variables over here. So let's take a closer look at this constraint, what it means. Okay, so it turns out that it's very useful to think of sigma x on any bond as like the exponential of an electric field. Okay, so this is it's a very strange electric field that takes on values only 0 or 1. Okay, so when it's 0, this guy is 1, and otherwise it's 1. And then you can look stare at this constraint and realize that it's just Gauss' law. So the constraint, this GR operators that are giving us the constraint, is actually e to the I pi. So these are the eigenvalues. So this is an operator as well, right? They're both operators. Is that, yeah. You don't have to worry about sign so much over here because signs of electric fields, because it's just a question of whether it's an even or an odd number that matters. Okay, so taking a product of sigma x on this cross is like adding the electric fields on the cross, which is just the divergence of the electric field. Okay, so really this constraint is just Gauss' law. It says that once you know the distribution of gate charges, you really know the longitudinal part, the divergence part of an electric field. It's not some independent variable as you might have thought to begin with. Okay, it's completely, the longitudinal part is completely constrained once you specify these numbers over here. And the rest of the dynamics has just got to do with the non-longitudinal, the transverse parts of the gauge field. So that's the constraint, if you like. Now the limit in which we are living is where all of these sigma x's are 1. In other words, I have no electric fields. E is 0 everywhere in this particular limit. And changing the electric field costs a lot of energy. Okay, so if I want to take a bond, right now it's just 0 everywhere, and flip its value to E equals 1, that costs me an energy H. Okay, so immediately you see that this system has got a linear potential between charges. So suppose I had an Ising charge at some point. Okay, this means that I've got to radiate the right amount of electric field, unit electric field basically. So electric field is 0 everywhere except on this bond, and then it goes on until it meets its partner, some other charge. We want to know what is the potential, what is the energy of this configuration. And clearly in this limit where it's very expensive to make electric fields, these electric fields just run along the shortest path to the other charge. And this costs you an energy that's linear in H times the length of this, the separation between the charges. Okay, so you have linear confinement of gate charge in this regime. So we're really looking at the confined phase.
Are where's the, it's very important that the EC2 field is compact, right?
Say?
It's a compact field, and therefore you get the string.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is just...
Enter, I mean, you're just discussing so this nicely in the...
Yeah, it's just 0 or 1, right? The gauge field.
Right?
Yeah. So it's a 2-point, in fact, it's just integer.
Think about just as Gauss's law, isn't the natural constraint of GR of psi equals psi and not minus psi?
Yeah, so actually that depends on the filling. So let's do the other problem where... let's do the same limit for this case. Okay, so we saw that in this situation, the constraint I got in this strongly confining limit is NF equals 1 at every site. You can go through the analysis again for this limit, and so let's call that odd. So this is a distinction that will keep appearing throughout this talk. The other thing gives you NF equals 0 or 2. So now it's a question of physics. Which one are you interested in? So for many reasons, people have been interested in situations where you start with a Mott insulator. You start with a situation where you have one electron per site, which is essentially a spin, and that's this. And this is really the case that's relevant, where NF is 1. Now, of course, you could imagine a situation of a band insulator that's strongly correlated, and you want to find phases of a band insulator, and that has basically no spin per site, or no spin per unit cell. In which case you would take this. But the belief has been, and it's sort of reasonable, that you're much more likely to get this correlated physics in this limit. And materials also seem to show you that the materials we understand least are the ones that, basically the cuprates, for example, are ones that are in this limit. So that's the natural thing for condensed matter physics to take. And certainly for maybe if you're just interested in lattice gauge theories, models of elementary particles, you'd prefer something like this, which has got no background charge at all, therefore relativistically invariant. Okay,
so just playing with the software. So when you take even case in a band insulator, I guess there should also be a deconfining phase.
In this model there would be.
About a fractionalized band insulator or something?
Exactly, yeah.
So why not talk about it? It's absolutely interesting.
Sorry?
Why not talk about it?
Yeah, certainly one could talk about it. But both from phenomenology and from... actually, there's a lot of further interesting physics that you'll see for this odd case that's not just contained in lattice gauge studies of particle physics. Okay, so what I'll do now is to analyze in greater detail just this gauge theory. Okay, so imagine that you have some hopping and delta that's such that gaps out your spin-ons. Gaps out these F particles, and at low energies are just reduced to this guy. Just the pure gauge theory. And I'll tell you some very basic facts of this gauge theory that's been known for a long time, and go over that in some detail. Okay, so... in fact, I can just erase everything. Okay, so I'll start with the even case. I'll tell you what it means in a minute. So I just have on a square lattice these variables that live on the bounds. So I hope it's clear what this means. This is a product of sigmas on a plaquette, and you sum over all plaquettes. And then the constraint is that on the sort of cross for every site, okay, so you can also think of the odd gauge theory, which is product sigma x equals minus 1. I'll come to that in a minute. Turns out to be much more interesting, actually, this one. Okay, so what I first want to show you is that there are two phases in this model. We have looked at one phase, that's the confined phase, but it turns out there are two of them. And to do that, I'll perform a duality. It's very, very simple to do on this model, and show you that, in fact, it's the same as the 3D or 2 plus 1D Same as the 2 plus 1D transverse field Ising model under this duality transformation. Okay, so how does that proceed? So maybe I need some colored chalk. Okay, so we have these fields living on square lattice, let's say. And now I want to consider points that live on the dual lattice, so the centers of these things. Okay, so the first thing I do is solve this constraint. So I have product of sigma x on this square is just 1. So it's very natural to associate with each of these dual lattice sites an operator. Let me call it mu z that lives on these dual lattice sites. The bar denotes that it's dual lattice, which squares to 1. And which is defined in the following way, that if I want the sigma x on this bond, then I just take the product of the two operators, mu z here and mu z over there. Okay, so it's you'll see in a minute why this is very natural. So okay, let's take that definition of these dual operators and plug it into this equation over here. And clearly, if you go around across this way, that way, that way, so you'll pick up each of these mu's twice. And we have defined these mu's to be sort of idempotent, I guess. Their eigenvalues are just plus or minus 1, so they square to 1. Okay, so given that property of these mu's, this satisfies the constraint. Okay, so in fact, you can solve for what mu is in terms of the sigmas. It's you just take some point and take a curve that goes out to infinity. Let's call it C. And shouldn't be mixing up these things. And you just take all bonds that intersect this curve and. So it's just the product of sigma x's on this curve, and you take it out to infinity. Now, it's very easy to show that this, the choice of this curve doesn't matter, and it comes from the constraint that you have any closed loop, the products of sigmas just add up to 1. The product of sigmas is just 1, so you're guaranteed that it doesn't depend on the choice of the loop. Okay, so that's one variable. Now, it turns out that let's define another variable. So given any dual lattice site, I define the other one as being the product of sigma z's around a plaquette. Okay. So it's very natural to associate with every dual lattice site one plaquette. Take that plaquette, take the product, you get another variable that squares to 1. Now, these two variables, the mu z and this mu x, actually have exactly the same commutation relations as two Pauli matrices. Okay, so if you live on, so let's see why that's true. So let's take a particular site on this lattice. Now there's this curve that I draw out that gives, and all of these sigma x's are involved in the mu z that lives here. And of course, the mu x just involves this one plaquette, right? And you can see that at the same dual lattice point, you have one bond in common. That's this guy, and the Pauli matrices give you the right commutation relation. If you're at different plaquettes, different points, they commute simply because you either have no overlap between the two, or you have two operators that are common. It's the properties of curves. Anyway, you can show that these are basically these two can be represented in terms of Pauli matrices. And let's rewrite the Hamiltonian in these variables. Okay, so that's really trivial. You can, since we have this very conveniently given as a single and for H, I've got sigma x, and that's just a product of yeah.
All the matrices will produce something else, right?
Else.
Sigma z with sigma x will give sigma y, which is the third
property. Let's look at the anti-commutation properties. That defines it completely, right? The two anti-commute on the same side. And they commute on different sides. So like this is r equals r prime, r not equal to r prime. That defines your Pauli matrix algebra, if you like. And you, okay, you need to specify that it's two component. That's the lowest representation that gives you this algebra. So that's all you need. And you can check both of these. I told you why they anti-commute. They share one link in common with different sigma z's, sigma x and sigma z. And at different sides, they share either 2 or 0. So they commute. So you're home, basically. And you can check that it's got to be two-dimensional because just from the count of the number of degrees of freedom, your plaquette can either have flux or not have flux. And that's this mu x. Okay, so you see that this is just the Ising model in a transverse field. So what you've found here is that your even gauge theory, even Ising gauge theory in 2 plus 1 dimensions, just maps to a transverse field Ising model, which we know as two phases, right? So you know that if I just take this coupling H over J, H over K, for large values of H, this is an ordered phase where this mu has an expectation value, mu z has an expectation value. And then there's some phase transition over here, an Ising phase transition into another phase where it's disordered. And that's this limit where H is small. Okay, so now the question is, what are these two phases in terms of the gauge theory? Okay, so one thing that's useful to note over here is what do these variables mean, this mu x and mu z? So what mu z does is that it takes a loop and it takes a curve C that runs out to infinity and changes the sign of sigma z on each of these links. Okay, so essentially what it does, it gives you an Ising flux on the plaquette that you operate on it, on plaquette on which it lives. Right. So this is an operator that creates Ising flux. And the phase in which you give an expectation value to this operator is a phase where this flux is condensed. Okay, and you're having you have a situation where the gauge fields are fluctuating wildly. And this flux is, your electric fields fluctuate wildly, and this flux is condensed. So in the dual model, we have two phases. We have the disordered. So it's easy to see what the ordered phase is, because we've solved for this phase in the large H limit. That's just this confined phase. So this is in terms of the gauge theory. And what I'll show now is that this is really a deconfined. Okay, so the disordered phase of this dual model actually corresponds to the deconfined phase of the gauge theory. Okay, so there are many ways of defining, of making this distinction more precise. Over here, there's a strong indication that there are two phases because you have a phase transition. And you can do various things and not be able to get rid of this phase transition. But what you'd really like, some sort of order parameter written in terms of the direct variables, not these very non-local variables, that'll actually distinguish these two phases. Okay, it turns out that's not possible. Okay, there's no local order parameter that'll distinguish between these two phases. But you can still ask for some distinction that's that makes a qualitative difference depending on which phase you are in. In terms of the gauge fields. So the thing that's historically used is this thing called the Wilson loop. I'll spend a few minutes discussing it, but it turns out to be not that useful for our purposes, mainly because this is something that applies only when you have a pure gauge theory. So as soon as you have gauge theory with matter in the, what's called the fundamental, but you know, we always have that kind of matter in our theory. It turns out not to be able to distinguish between the two phases. Okay, a distinction that will be much more useful to us is one of topological order, and I'll get to that after this. But you know, for historical reasons, it's something that may be good to know what it means and why it's not so useful for us. Okay, so the idea is the following, that let's define an operator on our lattice. That's some that's associated with some closed curve. Okay, so this runs along the edges of my original lattice. Okay, and associated with this curve, you can write down an operator that's just product of sigma z along this curve. Okay, and what we'll do is we'll take expectation values of this operator and see how its expectation value decays as you go to larger and larger loops. Okay, and there'll be a qualitative distinction between the two phases. Okay, so what we want to do is we want to look at average of WC. The nice thing about this way of distinguishing the two phases is that it turns out that the distinction in this behavior is very closely, can be very intuitively identified with confinement and deconfinement. Okay, so so let's first work in the limit of very large H, okay, where we know we should be in the confined phase. but actually, before I do that, let me very quickly tell you a little bit about this odd gauge theory, okay, because it turns out in that case, you don't have to do any work to distinguish between the two phases. Okay, so let me tell you a very quickly about the odd gauge theory before I get to this Wilson loop thing. I think that may be a better thing. So let me leave this.
Yeah. Can I just ask a quick question?
Yeah.
Since you say it's not useful when there's matter fields, apart from using topological order, can you deduce whether systems confined or deconfined just by looking at the spectrum?
Yeah, so these are discrete gauge theories like Z2 and so on. In this case, just by looking at the spectrum on some topologically trivial manifold, let's say the plane, infinite plane, the spectrum doesn't give you information, it's just gapped. Okay, if you put it on some non-trivial topology, of course, you have this topological degeneracy that I'm sure you know about. Now, for the case of, say, U1 gauge theories, then you have this possibility because in the confined phase, you have no photon excitations. Whereas in the deconfined phase, you can look for low energy photon excitations. Now, something I hope to cover at some point during this talk is that it's very well known for a long time that just in 2+1 dimensions, with pure compact U1 gauge fields, there's no deconfined phase. It's always confining. But it also turns out that if you add gapless matter to this thing, you can get a deconfined phase. But then what you call a photon is not so obvious. It's some strongly interacting theory. There's no pole, for example. So then it becomes much more delicate question what it means to have deconfinement. But again, I think there are some very qualitative aspects that you can look at. See if you have a conserved flux, for example, that's a conserved quantity. It's got nothing to do with global symmetries, which can sharply define a deconfined phase. But yeah, it's.
At least half a year ago, it was still quite contentious, right? If there was a deconfining phase in U1 divided by U1 or something.
So it turns out with gapless bosons, it's very easy to show that you can have. It's much harder work with fermions, like Dirac fermions or something like that. So, I think there's been progress on that end as well, but things are still not so clear. Gapless bosons, it's almost trivial to show. In fact, I'll give you various examples which can be reinterpreted in that light. In fact, what I'm going to talk about just now has that feature in it. Okay, so what we want to do is we want to look at this odd Z2 gauge theory, which is the same Hamiltonian as previously, but with that constraint. And really, this is the limit we'd be interested in if you have spin a half on some square lattice with single spin a half per unit cell on some lattice. Okay, so now let's again go to this limit of very strong transverse fields H going to infinity limits. Okay, so previously...
This is just like putting a charge at each.
Exactly. So that's not allowed in relativistic theory, but here it's perfectly fine. Yeah, but breaks relativistic symmetry, right? Yeah, but somehow this is the natural choice for Mott insulators. Okay, so let's look at this H going to infinity limit. Previously we saw it was just a trivial limit, all sigma x equal to 1. So again, this thing likes to set sigma x equal to 1, but it can't, right? It can't set sigma x equal to 1 everywhere. You've got to satisfy this constraint. And guess how are you going to do that? So now the system wants to satisfy this constraint, but the minimum number of sigma x equal to minus 1s, clearly, right? So the way to do that, of course, is to have one and only one bond coming out of every site that has sigma x equal to minus 1, and keep one everywhere else. So what you essentially get for the distribution of electric fields is, I'm drawing these wiggly lines for the electric field being minus 1, the exponential of the electric field being minus 1. So you're forced into some pattern of this kind. Okay, only one bad bond coming out of each site.
So the precise pattern is gauge invariant.
Yeah, so electric fields are gauge invariant.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
make a gauge fix where you put a particular covering of the lattice, which is minus 1, so be very careful. It's a representative gauge fix.
No. All these different configurations are physically distinct because they're electric fields.
Okay.
They're not gauge fields. Yeah.
Okay. They all have the same energy.
They all have the same energy in this sick limit of H being precisely infinity.
And it's infinite compared to the even sector.
Exactly, yeah. But of course, we just live in this odd sector for this theory. So now let's, switch, move away a little bit from that sick limit of H being precisely infinity and look at what this term does. And again, this, so I don't know if I mentioned this, but there's a huge degeneracy of states where you can have this constraint satisfied. One and only one bad bond coming out of every site.
So if I go back to a chart, go to the new variables, go back to the usual Ising model, so is it a checkerboard pattern or what does it
Okay, so that's a good question. You can ask what happens when I dualize this theory.
Yeah.
So it turns out to be almost the same as this theory, except you end up with a static field that lives on the bonds. And this static field is such that you have a minus 1 on taking any placket. In other words, it's a fully frustrated Ising model, transverse field Ising model. So...
So take the Ising model and then try to make it a frustrated every placket, basically.
Yeah. So one thing you could do is pick one bad bond in every thing. And what you pick doesn't matter. It's for the physics of the model. So yeah, the dual theory is a fully frustrated Ising model. And you can see this physics over there as well. There's a huge degeneracy in this limit where you don't have transverse field, you just have Ising coupling. Okay, so let's include a little bit of this K term to lift this degeneracy. And you can see what this does is to flip bad bonds around. Okay, so when you take this on a plaquette, of course, each of the sigma z's changes the value of the electric field. And you can only live in this low energy sector if you find a plaquette that has two of these bad bonds parallel to each other and then flip them around. Okay, so this gives you these kind of transitions. So you don't have to move out of the sector in order to get kinetic energy from this term. Just live within the sector, and it likes to have bonds that it can flip around. Okay, you gain kinetic energy from doing that. And essentially, at the end of the day, what happens is that these things like to order in some pattern, these bad bonds. And of course, any ordering of this will break lattice symmetries. So the thing that's believed to happen, this is a detail which you can choose to ignore, but it turns out that the pattern they pick with a little bit of this hopping is something that looks like this. Okay, it's a...
When you talk about bad bond, you're not looking at excitations of this model, sorry.
No, so I'm just looking at this gauge theory. I'm calling bad bonds the places where you have electric field. And the other places are where you don't have any electric field, those are just...
The ground state, the rule is that everyone has the product minus one, so that's that. So this will not be the ground state.
No, this has that property.
That's my bond.
So it's...
It's just one bond from each side. Only one.
So these are electric field equal sigma x equal minus one. Yeah. Yeah. So this is some pattern that breaks translation symmetry. Now you can...
Is this not a proven fact?
Sorry?
This is not proven?
I mean, no, it's been... That. Yeah, it's... So what you can do is you can take this... You can take this transverse field Ising model, work in the limit of h much larger than k. You can map it to a stat-mech model. It's fully frustrated Ising model with stacks ferromagnetically coupled to each other. And do Monte Carlo on that. And you find...
You just mean that each bond is one frustrated link?
Yeah. Yeah, and that bond can be anywhere. It doesn't matter. As long as you make one, show that one and... Yeah. So, I mean, that's how it's known thing. Okay, so you can start moving away from this point. So this is the limit h over k being very large. That's why we saw we had this... thing, the sort of staggering of electric fields. Clearly, this is a confined phase. You know, there's some, yeah.
There seems to be global degeneracy of this state. Is there in any way to this topological things that discussed? And you can go horizontally or vertically. Or...
Yeah, it's not topological. It's just it's translation symmetry breaking and rotation symmetry breaking. So you don't have to, you know, you don't have to put the system on a torus or something. You just look at it and you know it's. So these electric fields, again, as I said, are physical. Often in real spin models, they'll correspond to singlets occurring or not occurring across the bond. So it's something that you can...
Actually, it's the dimer models, right?
Yeah, exactly. So this is really the dimer model. It's sort of, it's coming out of an Ising gauge theory. But so what happens as you reduce... So this is clearly a confined phase. Okay. Now, as you reduce the value of h, it turns out you can get situations where you have not one but three bad bonds coming out. Okay, and so you'll have more and more fluctuations of that kind. And again, it turns out that you have a phase transition into another phase, which you can easily see by looking at the Ising model. So clearly, there's a limit where this is a paramagnet when k is very large, there's a phase transition. And this is really the deconfined phase. And this phase, there's no translation symmetry breaking. Okay, it's just uniform. So in this, for this odd gauge theory, you don't have to do any work to distinguish these two phases. If it's confined, it has to break translation symmetry, it turns out. Whereas if it's deconfined, if it's translationally symmetric, then it means it's deconfined. Okay, that's the same thing that Leon mentioned in his talk, that if you have spin a half per site, and you have some...
it has to... It's a lattice anyway, so you mean it just breaks
the discrete lattice translation symmetries.
But it's still translation invariant under two lattices.
Yeah, so it breaks it down to a smaller group, half the group. Yeah, it's actually there are four states that are degenerate. You can either pick this way or that way, and you can move them by one step.
I get it right. The deconfined state of the odd model and that of the even model are the same phases. They're indistinguishable.
They are very different Hilbert spaces, but yeah, in principle, yeah.
The same Hamiltonian, they're separated by infinite energy, always.
But yeah, some model sense, I guess, yeah. Well, okay, you've got to be a little careful about those things. So if you dope such a system, you get one of these fractionalized, you can get a fractionalized Fermi liquid that has the wrong volume, wrong lattice of volume. You dope an even gauge theory, you'll end up with, again, a fractionalized Fermi liquid. It's exotic, but it'll have the right volume. So there are subtle, there's some subtle distinctions. There are also the differences in, you know, I'll come to this topological order. So actually, the short answer to your question is yes, there's a difference. So it'll turn out that Voisins carry momentum over here. So. Okay, but one thing I'll just leave you with is that it turns out this transition is not Ising, but XY. Okay, so that's sort of, you can reinterpret that in a very nice way in terms of thinking of actually U1 gauge theories that are becoming deconfined at a point when you have gapless matter fields. But okay, so let me maybe.
Can you elaborate on this?
okay, so So what, you know, one way of thinking about, you know, this state, we got it from this model, right? This gauge theory and this extreme limit. But if I just gave you a model like this, where you have, you know, bad bonds that live on certain sites, and one and only one bad bond coming out of a site, and that, you know, doing these sort of these moves, it turns out it's more convenient to formulate it as a compact U1 gauge theory. Okay, so there's one, this is an electric, it's a real electric field. And these moves are such that it doesn't make use of the Ising nature of these electric fields. So total electric field is conserved, for example. Okay, so it turns out it's very natural to think of these as compact U1, but with some additional background charges living on your lattice. Now this transition then you can think of as condensing a charge 2 matter field. Matter field is as gate charge 2. Okay, so that can take you from U1 to something that's Z2. Because of the charge 2, you only count charge modulo 2. So that's really this transition. Now, when this charge 2 matter field is gapped, you have no hope because the U1 is confining. And you get this broken translation symmetric state because of the background charges. But exactly at the point when it's gapless, then this you can have a charged matter field that's gapless, it's bosonic, so it's only gapless at a point, coupled to photons. And so this, you know, in terms of the dual variables, it's just XY. This global symmetry is actually the conservation of electromagnetic flux. So you can reinterpret it as, you know, gapless.
I mean, we just got producing this old story by Giffelson and Fetkin, and so we such stuff also by Pilgrim's Guide in the old days, where the diamond stuff was solved in this language of your own fields. It's actually much simpler to think about.
I don't know if this transition was discussed in these terms in those days, but yeah, this is really the, you know, the powerful way of thinking about it.
In a low-tech term, it's that this is just this little confinement just gets bigger and bigger, and then you can have more stringy light, and then therefore look like the vortex pair dissociates and get like X Y. Is it just as that?
I'm not sure I'm following. Maybe we can chat. There are many ways of thinking about it. Yeah. So maybe we can discuss some particular ways later on. Okay, so so now let me, I'm not sure how much time I have, maybe about, looks like about 10 minutes or so, 5 to 10 minutes. If I want 1 hour, or it could, you know, depending on what people feel like, we could go over, take a short break now and go over a little bit, and yeah, let you decide, you know, in what process. But. Looks like 7 minutes.
I mean, some of us would like to hear more, so do you want to have a break at some point?
So do you want to take a break now when there may be still cookies?
Break?
Yeah, and then we come back in maybe 10 minutes or so.
Yeah.
Then
yeah.
I could go on for half an hour.
It's useful.
Yeah.
It's useful. It's like taking classes.
Yeah.
I mean, basically, like I've seen all of it, but it's good to
okay.
Eloquently explain.
Thank you. Okay.
Why is XY?